This is number 0057, the Stuff File Program, with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there. Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, once again, it's the Stuff File Program, number 0057. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File Program, meet Dr. Jeff Schweitzer, who is the author of Beyond Cosmic Dice, Moral Life in a Random World. He'll talk about the human brain and dispel some myths about it, such as the link between morality and religion.
It's not only a myth, it's largely accepted on faith, pun intended, I guess. Morality is derived from religion, but in fact, if we understand the brain better than we do, I think we'll find that, in fact, morality is a fundamental inherent characteristic of human beings, and it's derived from our evolutionary history and sociality, and that our brains are wired to understand and act on moral concepts.
Stephen Kleinedler is the supervising editor of 100 Words Almost Everyone Mixes Up or Mangles. What is the target audience for this book?
For some of these books, the target audience is concerned parents, and those are the ones where the 100 words are geared towards, you know, 100 words every high schooler should know, that kind of thing. The target market for this book are people who have insecurity about how they speak or write and want to make sure they're doing it right. The target market is also people who like to give inexpensive gifts to other people, and someone who might give this book as a gift is someone, you know, who is like gently prodding someone and saying, you should maybe check out some of the features in this book. I've heard you say or write this kind of thing. So there's different subsets that it would go out to.
We'll meet Steve Couch, the author of 99 Things You Wish You Knew Before Making It Big in the Media. He talks about many things, including what students aren't being told when they pursue a media career.
What they don't understand and what people really don't tell them is there are a lot of opportunities in the media where you're not in front of the camera, where you're not writing, and you're not in front of the microphone. And we need these people, because I'm very blunt in the book. As you know, in radio, if you don't have a great voice, you can't really be on the air. If you have a face that only a mother can love, chances are you're not going to be in front of a camera. And if you can't put two words together and can't spell, well, there's good news there, because they have editors. And believe me, editors for years made me a star at the Montreal Star and the Gazette and People Magazine and wherever else I wrote.
And we have lots and lots and lots of stuff, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0057, is Charles Goddard, my brother-in-law and my very first boss. He was a movie theater manager for many years before he retired. I was an usher and a projectionist working in the company for 6 years, starting at the age of 15. He's also heavily involved in his church, so he wanted me to pass along to our Montreal audience that St. Lawrence Anglican Church's International Night Dinner is taking place on Saturday, October 30th. And for more information, you can call the church at 514-366-4642. That's 514-366-4642. And thank you very much, Charlie, for doing the slate on this edition of the Stuff File program. Let's get right to the Stuff File news, shall we? And we start off with a story dealing with a guy in the British military, Lance Corporal John Lee, who is 27. An infantryman with the British Army's Yorkshire Regiment, served 2 terms in Iraq and then lost his leg to a bomb in Afghanistan. His heart stopped twice before medics could get him stabilized. Once he returned home to Coddington, he applied to the Nottinghamshire County Council for a disabled parking badge for his car. Seemed appropriate, don't you think? Yes. Well, each time he applied, that would be 3 times, he was denied the special permit. Would you like to know the reason why they wouldn't give him a special parking permit for the disabled? Yeah. The reason he is, and I quote, "He is young and may get better." That's what the council told him. Lee says, what do they expect? My leg to grow back? He parks in disabled spots anyway, since quote, sometimes the leg swells so badly I can't even get the prosthetic leg on, and has accumulated 800 pounds in parking tickets. That's about $1,250 U.S. Well, once the story hit newspapers, the council said it would urgently review his application. Urgently. Isn't that nice? Yes. Lee is missing a leg. The council is missing a heart. There you go. Okay, elsewhere, 29-year-old Jennifer Gilley of St. Clair, Michigan, is learning the joys of Louisiana jails because she apparently can't hold her liquor. Jennifer had called for a taxi in Covington, Louisiana, and accepted a ride to a city address. She apparently had been drinking, and after arriving, she allegedly refused to leave the cab. The driver said she refused to get out of the cab and told him she needed to go to Michigan. She then began taking off her clothes. The driver responded by driving his cab to a nearby police department. Figuring she was too intoxicated to cause further problems, he went inside the station to get help, but made the huge mistake of leaving the keys in the car. When he and officers came back outside, the cab and Jennifer were gone. She turned up in a parking lot about a block away. Police say she crawled back into the back seat and was still naked. After refusing to get out of the car, officers physically removed her from the car and put her clothes back on, and this was no small deal, by the way. She can face up to 8 years in prison if convicted. It's going to be a while before she sees Michigan again. Meanwhile, a bank robber in Vancouver, British Columbia, was handed a small amount of cash, and he made his getaway using a walker. It's not every day you get a 75-year-old male on a walker holding up a bank, said an RCMP spokesperson. The unnamed robber was caught about 45 minutes later. I'm probably guessing about 45 feet away. Meanwhile, in Moorhead, North Dakota, police had to cite 37-year-old Catherine Margaret Watson after she allegedly walked into a downtown Walgreens store about 5:45 p.m., wearing only a thong, pasties, a partial green towel, and whipped cream. She had actually come into the store to buy shaving cream and told police that she was a free thinker and was trying to make a statement. She said she wanted to catch people's attention and to get them to think outside the box and not to conform to society's views. Ms. Watson later admitted that her actions might have been a little over the top. She was cited for indecent exposure. Wonder if she was caught in the melon department. Oh, I know I shouldn't have gone there, but heck, I did. The devil made me do it. And while we're on the devil, you've heard the stories of people seeing the image of Jesus on everything from pieces of toast to concrete slabs. Well, apparently Satan has decided to get into the action. Laszlo Szrefko spent a small fortune renovating his bathroom in his home in Budapest. But now, nobody in his family will enter the room after spotting what they are sure of is the image of Satan's face in one of the newly installed bathroom shower tiles. After taking her first shower in the new bathroom, Laszlo's horrified wife, Andrea, fled from the room screaming after spotting the horned head of the devil in one of the tiles. She said, "I was naked, coming out of the shower, and I could suddenly see his eyes staring at me. I just screamed and ran." Laszlo said, "We can't clean it off, and it wasn't there when we put up the tiles. It just appeared overnight, and nothing can move it. The room is always ice cold, no matter how high we turn the heating up." Wow, there's irony for you, huh? "And we've just stopped using it because it's all too spooky." The couple now plans to call in an exorcist to cleanse their bathroom of evil spirits. Ooh. That's creepy, way too creepy. Perhaps we should just move on to our first guest, okay? On the line with us right now is Jeff Schweitzer. He is a PhD and marine biologist. We have had him on the old show several times, usually talking about various topics such as global warming and environmental issues. But this time around, we have him talking about something else entirely different. We are talking to him about the human brain. Hi, Jeff. How are you?
Good. How are you today, Peter?
I'm fine. Thanks for being on the program with us. It's an interesting concept. Do we know everything there is to be there is about the human brain, or is there still a lot of mystery about it?
We don't know quite a bit about it. There remains a tremendous amount of mystery, but having said that, the amount of progress that's been made over the last 20 years has been spectacular.
Now, you've written a book, by the way. I should mention the title of your book because I find the title rather interesting, Beyond Cosmic Dice, Moral Life in a Random World.
Right.
You got to explain that title.
Well, the title is meant to reflect the randomness of life's vagaries. And the book is about morality without religion. And it's based on the fundamental concept that life is random and has no inherent purpose, and we have to create our own purpose in life. And so that's where the title comes from, the random nature of what you get when you roll dice.
And speaking of religion, there is some myths into the part of, I guess, our brains that morality and religion lie.
Right. Well, that's it. It's not only a myth, it's largely accepted on faith, pun intended, I guess. It's largely accepted on faith that morality is derived from religion. But in fact, if we understand the brain better than we do, I think we'll find that, in fact, morality is a fundamental inherent characteristic of human beings, and it's derived from our evolutionary history and sociality, and that our brains are wired to understand and act on moral concepts.
The thing I find interesting about that theory is that you often hear more and more these days of court cases where people are using a defense that, well, he or she didn't mean to do it. It's the way their brain is wired.
Oh, well, that's really a fallacy, though, because we are controlling our own fate. One of the misconceptions about the idea that life is random is that you lose responsibility for your actions. Nothing could be further from the truth. We are masters of our own fate, more so because we are responsible for our own morality. Morality not being a gift from above, but something that we derive from ourselves. We have a greater responsibility to behave well and well toward others. So the idea that you are not responsible for your actions because your brain is wired a certain way really doesn't make any sense. You can invert that argument and say you are specifically responsible for those actions because your brain is wired that way. It offers no excuse for any ill behavior at all.
We often think of ourselves as being at the top of the food chain and being the so-called higher species on the planet, that we are that way because of our brains. Is that necessarily the case? Are our brains better wired than other creatures on this planet?
No, it's quite incorrect, in fact. First of all, evolution does not work on a hierarchical basis. It's not a tree where we're on the highest limb. It's this massive bush of life, and we happen to be on the end of one twig. But every species represents the best that it can be at the moment at the end of that particular twig. And our brains do not distinguish us as much as people think. I mean, elephants and dolphins, for example, have proportionately almost as large of brains as we do. There are a number of ways to measure the importance of brain development, brain-to-body ratio, cortical neurons, total weight, and in all of those measures, we are not disproportionately large. We don't have any claim to fame because of big brains.
What about the whole idea that size matters? I guess what you've just said is that is not the case, obviously.
Well, size does matter as one measure, but really more important, there are two really independent measures: total weight of a brain, and of course, an elephant's brain and a blue whale brain, you know, puts us to shame in terms of total mass and weight. But then you can adjust for that by saying brain to body weight ratio. So how big is your brain relative to how big you are? But even in that measure, we don't come out particularly big relative to other primates, dolphins, and elephants. But then you can say, okay, well, none of that really counts. It really matters how densely our cortical neurons are developed, because that's where we really shine. But even that's not true. Even our cortical development is not particularly impressive relative to other animals. It's gradually better, but not spectacularly so.
Another statement that we often hear that I now hear is somewhat of a fallacy is that we don't use all of our brain. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's one of those old wives' tales that we only use 20% of our brain. No, we use 100% of our brain. All brain areas are being engaged appropriately at all the right times. That just happens to be one of those myths that got perpetuated over time, but it really has no basis in biology at all.
I'm also hearing some interesting studies dealing with people who have traumatic brain injury and situations like stroke, in that in some cases it's been said that the brain can actually by itself rewire itself to a certain degree. Or well, bypass?
Yeah, that's true. It's called neuroplasticity. One of the things that I studied in graduate school, actually, after I got my PhD, I mean, as a postdoc at the University of California, Irvine, was neuroplasticity. Yeah, it used to be thought that once the human brain formed, the adult brain formed, no new neurons developed, and that's absolutely no longer, it's just not true. We know, in fact, that the brain can rewire itself in the face of trauma and does so regularly. And in fact, the brain often rewires itself in the absence of trauma as parts of learning and memory, the normal parts of learning and memory.
So what about, again, going back to the issues of morality, religion, good, bad, evil, are those things predetermined? Is a person predetermined to be moral or good or bad or religious or what?
No, I mean, I don't believe any of us are predetermined to be anything. We are we are the result of a combination of our genes and environment, and that will place differential emphasis on the result depending on our individual circumstances. But we all, as human beings, because of our evolutionary history and sociality, have an inherent moral characteristic. How that's developed and to the extent to which it's developed depends on numerous other factors in addition to our genetic core, including the environment that we're brought up in and our own predisposition, our own personality toward what we want to pursue. It's not a black or white, or it's a very gray area. People want black and white, simple answers. And when you come to something as complicated as human behavior and morality, it just doesn't parsed like that. It's more complicated. We are the result of a combination of numerous interdependent actions acting on us.
I've come across people in the same families who are completely different. I've come across,
right,
and they were raised together. I've come across twins who were completely different, and they are raised together.
Right. I mean, genetics is not destiny. That's what I mean when we say we really are masters of our own fate. We all have, of course, we all have our genetic legacy. I mean, we are a combination of the genes passed on through our predecessors, our relatives. But that is not a preordained fate. We can take what we have and manipulate it in a way that is very unique to us, and it is not in any way cast in stone because of our genetic makeup. We are responsible for who we are.
As children, how fast are our brains developing? Is it a rapid rate?
Yeah, they develop extraordinarily rapidly because the odd thing is they're so undeveloped when we're born. Primates have this problem. As our brains got bigger, the female pelvis did not. So in order to solve the problem of our big brains, human babies are born very early in development. And so what happens is after birth is a huge period of incredibly rapid brain growth. Huge number of neurons are being developed and lots of connections are being made. So we are a little bit odd that way, that we're born, but our brains are very poorly developed at birth, but then quickly develop after that.
So are you saying in a perfect biological world, human gestation should be longer than 9 months?
Absolutely. It would be more like 18 months.
Really?
But an 18-month baby couldn't pass through the birth canal.
I guess when, so.
Yeah, I mean, in order for that to happen, the women's hips would have to be so wide they couldn't walk properly. I mean, that's the only solution is to have the baby born early and then have the brain develop later.
Mm-hmm. You just scratched the surface on literally in so many areas pertaining to the brain. It's a fascinating topic. Jeff, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program. I should mention your website, which is www.jeffschweitzer.com. And the book is Beyond Cosmic Dice, Moral Life in a Random World. I thank you very, very much for being on the program with us once again.
Peter, thank you for having me. It's always a delight.
Dr. Jeff Schweitzer, his book is called Beyond Cosmic Dice, Moral Life in a Random World. His website is www.jeffschweitzer.com, and you can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0057, and you'll find links to Jeff's website, plus links to either amazon.com or amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of the Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Pay very close attention. There could be a test later.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to one of the editors of 100 Words Almost Everyone Mixes Up or Mangles. Plus, we'll also talk to Steve Couch, author of 99 Things You Wish You Knew Before Making It Big in the Media. Of course, we always end off the show with an idiot of the day, and we have one this time around as well. Plus, lots and lots and lots of stuff, more stuff right here, right now. You know, just days after Florida-based Pastor Terry Jones threatened to burn copies of the Quran to mark the 9/11 attacks, and by the way, I was seriously thinking of counterbalancing Jones's Quran burning by freezing a copy. Anyway, an Australian lawyer posted a 12-minute video clip online showing himself tearing pages out of the Bible and the Quran and smoking them. The video was reportedly posted over the weekend on YouTube while the U.S. was observing the 9th anniversary of the attacks last week. The video, entitled Bible or Quran, Which Burns Best?, shows Alex Stewart, an atheist, tearing up and lighting up the rolled-up pages of the Bible and the Quran. YouTube, by the way, has since deleted the video. The incident sparked international outrage, and Stewart's employer, Queensland University of Technology, is considering firing him. Referring to Jones's plan to cancel the burning of Quran, Stewart, in his video, said, "With respect to books like the Bible and the Quran, whatever, just get over it." Defending his right to freedom of speech, Stewart told reporters that the video was only a joke, adding that he was only smoking grass clippings. He said, "People do this stuff all the time, and if people get really upset about this, then they're taking it far too seriously." Okay. So this guy, Alex Stewart, is an atheist. I've often wondered one thing about atheists. You know, because when they die, they still put them in a coffin, a nice suit, and that's it. And I'm thinking, wow, talk about the saying, all dressed up and no place to go. Anyway, moving right along, there's nothing wrong with posting romantic pictures of you and your fiancé on Facebook. And there's nothing wrong with marrying a girl half your age. Well, that is unless, of course, you're 27 and she's 14. 27-year-old Robert Nixon Jr.'s wedding plans were ruined after Delaware County, Pennsylvania authorities had a chat with his 14-year-old fiancé. Police said Nixon recently took the girl to the mall and bought her an engagement ring. They met about a month ago through a mutual friend. Some mutual friend, huh? Yeah. The juvenile told investigators that she had sex with Nixon on at least four occasions at the apartment where he lives with his father. So Nixon has been charged with statutory sexual assault, aggravated indecent assault, corruption of minors, and related offenses. Courtroom documents state that Nixon and his intended bride knew they were doing something that was illegal, but they, quote, didn't think they would get caught. You put it on Facebook, pal. Anyway, But they did get caught after stupidly posting pictures of themselves together on Facebook. Their profile pictures were pictures of the two of them together, and both posted updates stating that they were, quote, in love and engaged, according to police. I'm assuming her status now on Facebook is, it's complicated. But, you know, it was complicated before. Anyway, moving right along, organizers are preparing for what is believed to be the first ever pageant exclusively for young ladies convicted of mafia-connected crimes. It's the Miss Mafia pageant, and contestants are allowed to post their pictures on the contest website only after submitting a police mugshot to prove their background. Other vital statistics submitted to judges in Budapest, Hungary include their actual charges and time spent behind bars. One finalist, identified only as Anna, said, "I was told by my friends several times to go out for a beauty pageant, but I couldn't because they rule out anyone with a criminal record." The winner, who gets a car and a free apartment in Budapest, will be decided at a finals pageant at a bar that was once bombed out in a mafia clan fight. One organizer proudly bragged, "We have thieves, fraudsters, gang members, bank robbers, and swindlers, so it should be an interesting night." Wow, how do you get disqualified from a contest like that? Oh, I know. Not having a criminal record. There you go. That's basically what it takes. Well, the morals bar is set kind of low for this one, don't you think? Okay, this upcoming election season taking place in the United States just keeps getting weirder and weirder. In Louisiana, long-shot Senate candidate Mike Spears says he wants to bring honor back to his home state and specifically wants to bring back the art of the duel. But he doesn't want to use pistols this time. No, he's a modern fellow. He's challenging Louisiana Senator David Vitter to a mixed martial arts cage fight next month in the run-up to the election. Now, Spears is quite serious and says if he can't beat Vitter at the polls, he's at least hoping to beat him in the ring, or cage, as it were, and is calling this match to, quote, restore the honor of Louisiana, unquote. He added, "This fight will symbolize the epic battle between the American people and an out-of-control, tyrannical federal government and the reckless politicians at the helm." Spears then accused Vitter of having blood on your hands at a press conference and said, "I think it's time you have blood on your face." Wow, surprisingly, Senator Vitter doesn't seem interested in participating in a cage fight. Surprisingly. So, there you go. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News with me, Peter Anthony Holder, we go to Everett, Washington. Prosecutors in Washington State say an 18-year-old woman stabbed a 19-year-old man for teasing her about her feet being smelly. The Herald of Everett reports the man was found by police with a steak knife sticking out of his back, buried in a few inches. His lung had collapsed. Officials say he'll recover. Charging papers say trouble started when Dallas Amber Smith was drinking and hanging out with friends and was challenged to do a backflip. When she took off her shoes to do the backflip, the teasing started. Smith has no criminal history. She faces charges of second-degree assault with a deadly weapon. Someone needs an anger management class, I'm thinking here. Definitely. Okay, let's get to our next guest on the Stuff File program, shall we? Have you ever suffered the embarrassment of having your remarks corrected by a family member, colleague, or stranger? Well, the book, 100 Words Almost Everyone Mixes Up or Mangles, presents 50 pairs of words that people have trouble getting right and keeping straight. It's from the editors of the American Heritage Dictionaries. On the line with us right now is supervising editor Stephen Kleinedler. Hello, Stephen.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on, Peter.
Thanks for being here with us. So, only 50 words? That's the other thing.
This is part of a larger series. We have about a dozen 100 words titles out, and this is one of three in a set. There's 100 words almost everyone confuses and misuses, 100 words almost everyone mispronounces, and 100 words almost everyone mixes up or mangles. Between the three of these books, we get most of the major items that people like to carp about.
Well, the reason why I say only 100, because I know the series of books, but it just, you as editors, getting to weed it down to that, it must have been a difficult process.
Oh, right. There's certainly a lot of source material we can use. We started with the usage notes in the American Heritage Dictionary. We also have a style book, and then we have our usage panel that we ballot frequently on usage issues, and we take the data that come from those survey results. And there are plenty of other things that we could still talk about on top of this, but, you know, 100 makes for a nice bite-sized book.
Okay, so I'm sure even though it was difficult to weed it down. Amongst the editors, there must have been a few words that were definitely going to be in the book. What are some of the ones that people tend to mess up a lot?
Well, ones that we wanted to do a couple different things for this book. So this one includes, whereas the other one doesn't, some phrases. So for example, hold one's peace versus speak one's peace, where hold one's peace, you're using the P-A-C-E spelling, but the other idioms that use peace, like a piece of one's mind and say one's peace, are with P-I-E-C-E. So we went beyond we talk about words being used incorrectly within idioms in this book as well.
Ah, okay. Now, it's interesting you bring up some idioms because those tend to change with time. We hear things that our parents and grandparents used to say, but aren't necessarily in the vernacular as much as they used to be.
Well, certainly some idioms, it depends on how slangy or informal they are. Certainly, like, you know, someone being the bee's knees, that's a idiom that we'd associate with the Roaring Twenties. Other idioms, like kick the bucket, have persevered for a longer period of time.
Yeah, you don't call anyone a Hellcat anymore, do you?
No, no 23 Skidoo, any of that.
who do you look for as far as your reading audience is concerned? Who are the who's the target market for your book?
Well, these for some of these books, the target audience is concerned parents, and those are the ones where the 100 words are geared towards, you know, 100 words every high schooler should know, that kind of thing. The target market for this book are people who have insecurity about how they speak or write and want to make sure they're doing it right. The target market is also people who like to give inexpensive gifts to other people, and someone who might give this book as a gift is someone, you know, who is, like, gently prodding someone to say, you should maybe check out some of the features in this book. I've heard you say or write this kind of thing. So there's different subsets that it would go out to.
Well, that brings up the other point, too, and I mentioned it in the introduction that, you know, some people might have family members, colleagues, or even strangers correcting them. Most people don't like to be corrected.
Well, and that's true. And there's a degree of, you know, social norms there and rudeness, too. If I'm in a social setting with friends, I will almost never correct anyone. The context would have to be pretty special for me to, you know, if we're actually talking about usage, or it's someone who's made a point of wanting to be corrected, or an example, a friend of mine who's an architect was using the legal term prima facie. And he spelt fascia like the architectural term instead of the Latin way, and I thought that was kind of interesting because he was, you know, talking about a building piece. And in that regard, I pointed it out because it was interesting. But it's kind of rude, you know. You want to be careful how you go about correcting people. There's a time and a place for it, obviously.
Which brings up the difference between, in some cases, standard or what I'm in Canada, what we would say British forms of spelling and American forms of spelling, like the word theater.
Right. Theater or center or any of the words ending in I-Z-E versus I-S-E. And I believe there's some, when in Rome, obviously if you're, writing to a British audience or your British editor is probably going to spell your words I-S-E instead of I-Z-E. So with some things there's more than one norm and you'll just want to adapt to wherever you are or as long as you're internally consistent. I think if, you know, a British writer were to come over here and pen something, I don't think anyone would look askance if he or she ended their words in I-S-E. That's just how British English spells, the I's prefix, a suffix.
Now, you say you don't necessarily want to correct people in social settings. However, Your friends and family obviously know what you do. I'd be leery if I was in a situation and I said something and you didn't say something to correct me, but everyone looked to you. It's like, okay, what did I just do?
Well, yeah, I mean, my friends and family do know me well enough, and I've also told them, you know, don't be on guarded speech. Don't worry about it. I'm not here to, you know, I'm off the clock. I'm not here to point fingers, usually.
The rules and regulations you talk about in the book, though, because the English language is a living, breathing thing, and it does change over time. Are these things that, in your estimation, are just out and out mistakes and would never change, or are these things that over time are changing?
We have a bit of both. There's some rules that will probably never, ever change. Ain't will always be considered non-standard. Irregardless will probably always be considered non-standard simply because there's so many school teachers and language critics saying this is incorrect, and it's drummed into everyone's head. Many things will kind of even out over time. Items that may have been considered non-standard two or three or four decades ago are now considered, par for the course and not controversial at all. So it depends on the word. It depends on the degree to which it's condemned.
Oh, as a broadcaster, you just touched on the word I hate the most, irregardless.
Oh, yes. Irregardless is, again, one of those words that is roundly condemned, mostly because everyone says it's wrong. I doubt it will ever become standard simply because so many people think it's wrong. But it just goes to point how illogical English is as a language. The reasons that people argue against the word irregardless, we have many examples of perfectly good English words that follow the same pattern. For example, unravel means the exact same thing as ravel. Debone means the exact same thing as bone. And yet unravel and debone are both perfectly acceptable English words.
And there's flammable and inflammable?
Oh, yeah. There's inflammable is a word to be avoided simply because it causes so much confusion. Some people take the in to mean not. When you want to talk about things that don't catch on fire, you're better off saying non-flammable. And if you want to talk about things that catch on fire, you're better off saying flammable, simply because so many people may misconstrue inflammable. Inflammable means the exact same thing as flammable, of course, but because of the prefix in has multiple meanings, sometimes people think inflammable might mean not able to catch on fire, and in that case, can actually be dangerous. So it's best to avoid it, I think, and just use either flammable or non-flammable.
And I've always wanted to know why people who are very, very upset are disgruntled, but I, as a happy person, am never gruntled.
Right. There. You've probably never been made either, dismayed. English, again, isn't necessarily logical, and there's a lot of items like that appear throughout the language. You can be canny, the opposite of uncanny. It's more of a Scottish term, I believe. And the gruntle, although there isn't an English word gruntle, it did exist in Middle English, and it's related to the word grunt. It's just a term that fell out of use in modern English.
Well, one of the fun things about this and the other books that you have is that I'm sure it, in a group of people, it causes a conversation, which is always fun if you see somebody reading this book. The book is called 100 Words Almost Everyone Mixes Up or Mangles. And I thank you very, very much, Steve, for being on the program with us.
Thank you. I had a great time. Thank you very much.
Stephen Kleinedler, supervising editor on the book, 100 Words Almost Everyone Mixes Up or Mangles. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com. Go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0057, and you'll find links to either their website or links to Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order the book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones. Schools across America opened their doors again last week. Good news for parents, maybe not so happy news for students. But in one West Virginia school district, the students were so upset they started a petition drive. It wasn't to bring back summer, though. No, there was another reason for this petition. They were protesting to bring swing sets back to their playgrounds. You see, school officials there removed all swing sets because of lawsuits. Personal injury lawyers recently forced the schools to settle two expensive lawsuits over common injuries. So, to avoid more lawsuits, the swings were removed. Let's be fair, could we find a more troubling example of how lawsuit abuse is changing America? Sure, you've heard me talk about the high cost of lawsuits, but the real problem is the negative impact these lawsuits are having on our quality of life. Are we better off because of these lawsuits? Of course not. Learn more about how lawsuit abuse is hurting everyone from school children to charities. Go to my website at bobderigojones.com.
What are they saying about if the rains don't cleanse? New York Times bestselling author David Mixner says, as a writer and advocate for Africa, I could not put down Ben Patrick Johnson's If the Rains Don't Cleanse. Aubrey Hooks, the U.S. ambassador to Ivory Coast, says, fascinating and hard to put down. If the Rains Don't Cleanse is CNN breaking news disguised as historical fiction. If people can't put it down, then why haven't you picked it up? If the Rains Don't Cleanse, the tale of missionaries in 1950s Belgian Congo is loosely based on my own parents' lives. It's available online, including Amazon.com and Amazon.ca. I, Ben Patrick Johnson, want you to read this book. My mother, Abidale Johnson, wants you to read this book. Now remember, this is a woman who survived as a missionary in Congo half a century ago. She is tough. Now do not make me send her your way. If the Rains Don't Cleanse, get it now, or deal with my mother. Coming to you from Canada, the land of universal health care, colorful money, and the correct spelling of the word theater. This is The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll meet Steve Couch, the author of 99 Things You Wish You Knew Before Making It Big in the Media. We also have an idiot of the day coming up as well, and one more Stuff File story to share with you right here, right now. You know, it can't be a very good feeling when you get locked up in prison and notice that they have a condom vending machine. Well, in the San Francisco County Jail San Bruno lockup, authorities have installed 16 condom machines for the jail's 750 prisoners. It's just the latest evolution in a safe sex program that began in 1989 when health workers began distributing condoms to inmates as part of their counseling before they were released. And although sex among inmates technically is illegal, the sheriff's department went ahead and installed the 16 machines anyway because, seriously, who are we kidding? As for the chance that all those machines will actually promote jailhouse sex, well, Kate Monaco Klein, who is directing the program for the city's public health department, says the sex already takes place. If providing condoms saves one or two lives, it's worth it. I tell you, if some people were terrified of going into prison, seeing those machines would just freak them out. That's not the place where you want to make new friends, if you know what I mean. Where the term I got your back has a new meaning. Anyway, let's get to our next guest on the program, shall we? On with us right now is a journalist and broadcaster and a man who was one of my many former bosses. He's also the author of a very successful new ebook called 99 Things You Wish You Knew Before Making It Big in the Media, a guide to avoid being eaten alive in the media jungle. His name is Steve Couch, and he joins us through the technology that is Skype to Skype communications. Hi, Steve. How are you?
I'm well, Peter. How are you doing there in Montreal?
I'm doing fine. My first question to you is, why are you giving away our secrets?
Well, the book is really aimed at two groups. The first group are the students, those who are chasing their dream to be in the media. And the second group, those who forgot their dream, are disgruntled and no longer happy in the media. So this is a book that will help them chase their dream or help them kickstart their dream and get them to be happy again in the media.
Now, media has changed both because of and in spite of technology. So I'm just wondering, do you find, and when you talk to young people, because I also know you go around to schools and you teach and you lecture, do you find that the goals and aspirations and dreams of those who want to get into the business are different than when you and I wanted to get into the business?
No, they have a dream, but they don't know how to chase it, and they really don't know what's out there. When you talk about media with students, they think you have to be in front of the microphone, in front of the camera, or writing for a newspaper, magazine, or what have you. What they don't understand, and what people really don't tell them, is there are a lot of opportunities in the media where you're not in front of the camera, where you're not writing and you're not in front of the microphone. And we need these people, because I'm very blunt in the book, Peter. As you know, in radio, if you don't have a great voice, you can't really be on the air. If you have a face that only a mother can love, chances are you're not going to be in front of a camera. And if you can't put two words together and can't spell, well, there's good news there, because they have editors. And believe me, editors for years made me a star at the Montreal Star and the Gazette and People Magazine and wherever else I wrote. But what's important to understand is we all have a dream. We are all born with something in our genes that makes us want to go in a certain direction, whether it's to be an artist, whether it's to be a mechanic, whether it's to be a painter, or whether it's to be in the media. And the role of the book is basically to help you understand that this is in your DNA. This is who you are. And you owe it to yourself to do everything you can to chase your dream and not let anyone tell you, Peter, that no, you can't chase your dream. Go sell shoes. I have always maintained in 40 years of working in the media and dealing with people that the only thing I had a right to say when I was in management is you can't chase your dream at my location. But that doesn't mean you can't be great someplace else.
Okay, so having said that, what is the fine line between those who are really chasing their dream and chasing their passion, and those who, let's be blunt, might be somewhat delusional?
The delusional part is a very interesting question and statement, Peter, because I believe it's one of the failures of our schools when it comes to journalism schools, radio and television schools, or colleges or institutions. I've always maintained that they accept anybody without really sitting down with them and saying, gee, you know what? You really don't have a voice. You really don't look good. You really can't, you know, you should be looking at something else. They don't do this for one reason. They want bums in the chair. They want the tuition paid, and they want their money. This is where the delusion comes in. I teach now at a number of colleges in Toronto. And I have to tell you that there are times when I'm teaching these students and I say to them, what are you doing here? Because you don't have the voice for radio, but you're a great writer or you're a great producer. They have great ideas and they come up with great stories. But they've been sold this bill of goods that I'm going to go to a college or a university and I have an opportunity to be on the radio or on television.
So you've written this book and it I guess shares some of the pitfalls you've experienced in the 40 years you've been in the business. To be honest, aren't some of those pitfalls some things you had to go through in order to be who you became down the road?
In a way, yes. A perfect example of, you know, of having the right voice to be on the radio. How I got into radio was because I knew somebody who became news director, and he wanted me to run his radio reporters at CJD in Montreal. I don't have the best voice for radio. I always wanted to be that narrator. When I grew up, I used to watch the Disney movies and the movies like The Flying Squirrel and things like that. I mean, this goes back into the late 50s, early 60s. But I would spend more time listening to the narrator than watching the movie, because that's what I wanted to do. And it became very clear to me after a while that I have a lot of contacts because I started off in newspapers and I got a lot of great stories and I could get the information. I got into radio. I was great for 45 seconds a minute on air. I was great to tell stories on air because I'm a storyteller. I was great in breaking news because voice didn't matter as much as content. But Bob Lamley, my news director at the time, really brought it home. I had done a documentary for CJ80 Radio, and I researched it, I did all the interviews, and then I voiced it. And the news director took me aside and said, Stevie, this is a good documentary. It's solid. There's great information there, but it's not a great documentary because in order to be great as a documentary, it has to have a great person on the air. It has to have a great talent. And Stevie, you're not that guy. Now, in order not to destroy me, he let me do the documentary on the radio. And I did it. And I listened to it. And I said, you know what? He's absolutely right. And here's the key where you play to your strengths and don't chase your weaknesses. Is I didn't win an award for that documentary. I never voiced another documentary, but I produced tons of them. And along the way, I've won more than a dozen awards, major awards, for my documentaries, because I was able to put them together and get the right people to voice them. So I'm still chasing my dream, but I'm chasing my dream in the sense of being realistic. And that's what the book is all about. It's about you can chase your dream, but don't get fooled into thinking the only way you can do it is to be in front of the microphone or what have you. Because
now,
it's not.
The title of the book is 99 Things You Wish You Knew Before Making It Big in the Media. But judging by the stories you're telling and the way you're telling it, could someone get something out of this book who's not interested in the media? In other words, it's the message of following your dream that is really important here?
Yes, because Peter, this book, while it talks about the media, it crosses all barriers here, because really what it's talking about is being positive. Positive will beat out negative all the time. I say in the book that 75% of the people in my industry, in the media, are negative. How do I know this? Because I used to beat them on a regular basis when I was on the street being a reporter. And they would tell me, my competition, they'd say, how did you get that story? And I'd say, well, I picked up the phone and I called, or I just went there. And they'd say, I figured they wouldn't talk to me, so I didn't bother. That is the biggest problem with the media today, is full of people who don't want to believe that they can get it. And I say very clearly, you should be in the 25%. And this goes not just for media, but this goes for anything you do in life. This is all about chasing your dream and being positive and understanding that if you try, you will succeed. If you don't try, you're guaranteed for failure.
Well, speaking of success, and we've got about a minute, you created this book, which is an e-book, and it's doing very well.
I'm got to tell you, for a guy from East End, Montreal, growing up on welfare, chasing my dream to be a reporter and then in radio and then running radio stations, the book is number one when it comes to journalism. It's in the top 10 when it comes to media. I'm just blown away, but people are getting the message that, you know what, this book can help me chase my dream.
And how do people get the book?
The best way to get the book is to go to the Sony Reader Store. You'd have to Google that because they've changed their URL, unfortunately. Or go to, because the book is part of the 99 book series of self-help books, go to www.99-series.com. www.99-series.com, and there all the books in the series are there, including mine, and you can order them online.
Excellent. The book is called 99 Things You Wish You Knew Before Making It Big in the Media, A Guide to Avoid Being Eaten Alive in the Media Jungle. It's written by Steve Couch, and I thank you very much, Steve, for being on the program.
Thank you for having me, Peter.
Steve Couch, the author of 99 Things You Wish You Knew Before Making It Big in the Media, A Guide to Avoid Being Eaten Alive in the Media Jungle. To find the ebook, you can just go to my website at thestufffile.com. Go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0057. And you'll find links to Steve's page at the Sony ebook store, where you can order the book directly. Steve's book is part of the 99 book series, and their website is 99-series.com. Again, you can find the links on my website. And by the way, you don't need an e-reader to buy the book. There is free software at both sites, so you can read the book on your PC, Mac, laptop, iPad, or iPhone. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, and we have just one more item to get through for this edition of the Stuff File program, and that would be the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff File presents the idiot of the day.
And this week's idiot comes from Australia. Two men were arrested after bewildered diners at a McDonald's spotted them wrestling a 5-foot python named Boris in the restaurant parking lot. Victoria State Police said the men stole an 8-year-old black-headed python and a lizard from a pet shop. They then brought the snake to the McDonald's parking lot, where they began wrestling with it in front of puzzled customers. The men, aged 22 and 24, were arrested and charged with burglary and theft. Police didn't release their names. Here's a quote from Detective Sergeant Andrew Beams, as told to the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. "In all honesty, it's just a case of dumb and dumber. Anyone who gets out there with a 1.5-meter python in a McDonald's car park, they're pretty dumb." The snake was returned to the relieved owner, Jody Graham. She's the owner of the Totally Reptiles pet shop. The lizard, by the way, is still missing. "He was a bit cold and stressed, so I had him in a tank warming up," she said. "I'm just glad that he is back." By the way, black-headed pythons are native to northern Australia. They are not venomous and aren't likely to bite unless they're hunting prey. But still, why would two guys rob a pet store, steal a python, and then wrestle with it in a McDonald's parking lot? One reason, and one reason only. They're idiots!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that wraps up this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, number 0057. The website is thestufffile.com, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the What's On page. Again, just look for the corresponding number. That's number 0057. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You could also find me on Facebook at facebook.com/PAHolder and Twitter at twitter.com/PAHolder. Hope to see you back here for our next show, on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJMedia.com, aboard Taiwan's national carrier China Airways for their long-haul dynasty flights, and over the air on World FM 88.2 in New Zealand, and also Gold FM 90.5 in Singapore. That's it. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. While it may be an enjoyable, pleasant experience, some side effects may occur. Listening to Peter may cause bloating, drowsiness, Tourette's, web feet, or an oily discharge.